I thought, as it was to be quite a short talk, I'd write it. So I hope that doesn't sort of interfere too much with any spontaneity. But I'll try not to enlarge on what I've got here. So I'm going to say something about the title a little bit later. Keep you a bit of suspense about that one. But, well, obviously the only way to avoid it is to get enlightened, really. So we'll put that one aside for the moment. I want to start with the Buddha's Parinirvana, because that's why we're here today, what we're remembering today. His death without remainder. On the surface of it, it looks like the Buddha had a rather unpleasant death. He was old, he was worn out, and he had a nasty bout of food poisoning as he lay between two sala trees to die. He'd stopped on his journey there at a mango grove where Kunda, the metal worker, had invited him for a meal. And he'd eaten something contaminated. He actually knew it was contaminated. And it's always been a bit of a mystery to me why he decided to eat this contaminated food. But he was very close to death anyway. Maybe he thought it didn't really matter. But he asked Kunda not to serve that dish to anybody else. And after he'd eaten it, he asked Kunda to bury the rest of what was left, what were the leftovers, so that nobody else would be poisoned. But he didn't tell Kunda there was anything wrong with the food. So at the end of his journey, he lay down for the last time. And he would certainly have experienced bodily pain. But his mind was totally free from any form of mental suffering. Those states that are so familiar to all of us, such as aversion, anger, resentment, jealousy, craving, intoxication, and all the others. It's hard for us to imagine what such a state of enlightenment is like as an actual experience. In the Parinibbana Sutta, the Buddha's attendant Ananda, who was his cousin and we know had attended the Buddha for probably about 20 or more years, is a key character in that last journey that the Buddha makes. Ananda was actually not enlightened, probably because he'd spent all his energy on serving the Buddha and particularly remembering all his teachings. And I think there's a teaching in that, which is that it's all very well knowing the teachings, but we've got to put them into practice and meditate with them, which probably Ananda didn't have a lot of time for. So as the Buddha is dying, Ananda is distraught and weeping. And the Buddha calls Ananda to him and he says, "Enough, Ananda, do not grieve, do not lament. For have I not taught from the very beginning that with all that is dear and beloved, there must be change, separation, severance. Of that which is born, come into being, compounded and subject to decay, how can one say, may it not come, to dissolution? There can be no such state of things. Now for a long time, Ananda, you have served the Tathagata with loving kindness in deed, word and thought, graciously, pleasantly, with a whole heart and beyond measure. Great good you have gathered, Ananda, and now you should put forth energy and soon you too will be free from the taints." And indeed, after the Buddha died, Ananda did gain enlightenment. Impermanence as a concept is something, of course, very familiar to us, one of the basic Buddhist teachings, and we see impermanence all around us. But somehow we manage to create a barrier between ourselves and impermanence, the truth of impermanence. So we fool ourselves that it tends to apply to other people and not to ourselves. In the 21st century, many people don't encounter death until perhaps their own middle age. Our own death can seem a great distance away. And we can put off reflecting on it unless, of course, perhaps one of our loved ones dies or we have the misfortune to be terminally ill. So the first half of the title of this talk, How to Avoid Death, is of course referring to our deeply ingrained habit of turning away from that reality. We find it hard to apply that reality to ourselves. It's not uncommon for people to reach the time of their death without actually being at all prepared. Often we're in denial, or fear means that we can't bear to face the fact of it happening. It's not easy to turn towards our deepest fears, but suppressing them, suppressing fear, only makes it grow until it becomes the bogeyman in our psyche. We avoid the whole reality of death by distracting ourselves with busyness, with plans and hopes for the future, as if we can guarantee living for a very long time. One of the most frightening things about contemplating death is fear of the unknown. We don't actually know what happens at death or after death, and no one can tell us reliably anyway, because no one returns to give us a report. Even accounts of near-death experience are open to a lot of debate. But I think what's interesting is the assumption that we commonly make that death will be an unpleasant experience, that it won't be as pleasant as being alive. Yet we have no evidence of that. Socrates had this to say: "To fear death is nothing other than to think oneself wise when one is not. For it is to think one knows what one does not know. No one knows whether death may not even turn out to be the greatest blessing of human beings, and yet people fear it as if they knew for certain that it's the greatest evil." And I found this rather lovely quote from somebody called Rossiter W. Raymond, who says, "Death is only a horizon, and a horizon is nothing save the limit of our sight." I find this a very beautiful comparison, that death is like a horizon which we can't see beyond. So perhaps we should learn to let go of negative assumptions that we might have about death. And of course, we can bear in mind the teaching of karma, in particular, death proximate karma, our state of mind that we're in at death. And, you know, that can motivate us to practice. Other poets and philosophers argue that because they've engaged fully with life, they're bound to take the engagement into death. So Amelia Josephine Burr, an American poet, wrote this. You're probably familiar with some of it. "Because I have loved life, I shall have no sorrow to die. I have sent up my gladness on wings to be lost in the blue of the sky. I have run and leapt with the rain. I have taken the wind to my breast, my cheek like a drowsy child, to the face of the earth I have pressed. Because I have loved life, I shall have no sorrow to die." So what's going to help us turn towards, in a positive way, the reality of impermanence and our own death? Confidence in the life we're leading. I think that's the prime thing. If we have chosen to follow the Buddhist path, then it's important to become increasingly clear about what it was that the Buddha taught and to be able to apply the teachings. Even as the Buddha was dying, a man named Subhadda came for a teaching. Now Ananda, in his concern for the Buddha, intervened, saying the Buddha was far too ill to be asked any questions. But the Buddha overheard Ananda and told him, "No, bring Subhadda to me." And he taught him the Noble Eightfold Path. As his parinirvana approached, the Buddha addressed his disciples, saying, "It might be, bhikkhus, that one of you is in doubt or perplexity as to the Buddha, Dharma or Sangha, the path or the practice. Then question, bhikkhus, do not be given to remorse later on with the thought, 'The Master was with us face to face, yet face to face we failed to ask him.'" So it's really important that we become clearer and clearer about the teachings. And we also need what I've called the three E's: ethics, emotional positivity, and enthusiasm. In brief, the more ethically sensitive that we become, the clearer our conscience will be, and we won't be carrying a lot of regrets to our deathbed. Our ethical practice enhances our meditation practice. It's a bit like cleaning up a computer's hard drive to free up space and improve the operation and speed. We remove temporary files that no longer have a purpose. In the same way, when we clean up our lives, our awareness becomes less occupied by unhelpful habits that are on our conscience. Emotional positivity is also important because, of course, it helps us turn towards all our fears and our insecurities. But we also need enthusiasm. If we meander through life feeling like life just happens to us in a random way, we'll never make any progress. The teaching of Karma Vipaka shows us how our behaviour today influences our future experience, and we need to be constantly aware of that truth. This reminds me of the story of Bahia, of the bark cloth, that's found in the Udana. So Bahia was a well-respected spiritual teacher. He was venerated and supported by the community, given robes and alms food. And one day when he was meditating, the question arose in his mind, I wonder if I'm one of those in the world who are arahants, or who have entered the path to arahantship. But then something spoke to him, a spirit perhaps, or maybe his own mind. You, Bahia, are neither an arahant nor have you entered the path to arahantship. You do not follow that practice whereby you could be an arahant. Well, he's a bit shocked at this. He says, then in the world, who are the arahants who have entered the path? Well, there is, Bahia, in a far country, a town called Sarvati. There the Lord now lives, who is an arahant, the fully enlightened one. So Bahia sets off immediately, and he only stops, it said, one night at each place, because he wants to get there so quickly. But when he reaches Sarvati, he finds that the Buddha is out on his alms round. So Bahia rushes off to find the Buddha, and when he does, he asks for a teaching. The Buddha kindly points out that, well, now's not quite the appropriate time, he's on his alms round. But as you know, if anybody asks the Buddha three times the same thing, the Buddha finally agrees. So he says to Bahia, herein, Bahia, you should train yourself thus. In the seen will be merely what is seen. In the heard will be merely what is heard. In the sensed will be merely what is sensed. In the cognized will be merely what is cognized. In this way, you should train yourself, Bahia. And this teaching has the profoundest effect on Bahia, and he gained enlightenment on the spot. After paying his respects to the Buddha for the teaching and going on his way, Bahia is attacked by a cow with a young calf and dies as a result. The Buddha, I think he sees the commotion on the way back from his alms round, and he gathers his bhikkhus together and he says, bhikkhus, take Bahia's body, put it on a litter, carry it away and burn it, and make a stupa for it. Your companion in the holy life has died. Bhikkhus, Bahia of the bark cloth was a wise man. He practiced according to Dharma. Bahia of the bark cloth has attained final nibbana. Pretty amazing, just from that one teaching. Well, we don't have the Buddha in our midst to ask for a teaching, but as he emphasized at his death, it is the Dharma that liberates, and that we do have. Someone who reminds me a little bit of Bahia was a Mitra who's no longer with us, and I've put her picture on the shrine there. So 2 years ago this very month, a Mitra called Sue Harrison was diagnosed with an aggressive lung cancer. She was given between 1 year and 5 years to live, but in reality she had just 6 months. She had been a practicing Buddhist for only about 4 years, but during that short time she'd taken the Dharma to her heart and she'd transformed her life. She was an impressive person. She had a lot of suffering in her life, including a long spell of hard drugs. But once she found the Dharma, she soaked it all up and took advantage of every opportunity available to her. Retreats, study, ordination process, the whole lot. And she was devoted to Sangharachitta, and I'm really pleased that she managed to have 2 meetings with him before she died. When she told me about that first visit, they'd obviously hit it off and talk like old hippies together. She never missed Mitra study, and once she even turned up with an eye patch in the dark, in the winter, having driven all the way from Great Yarmouth, having had a cataract operation that day. A little bit mad, but quite impressive. She was instrumental in that group in Great Yarmouth really taking off. She started it with Saroja and Sinadarkani. Apart from the actual teaching itself, she really ran that group. She did all its administration, its advertising, the befriending. When people booked on a course at Great Yarmouth, by the time they arrived at the class, they would greet Sue like an old friend. She was immensely kind to everybody. In the last months of her life, the order, all the order members here, we managed to set up the conditions so that she could be ordained and become Diavandana, which she did in July 2015, only 1 month before she died. She's a truly wonderful example of someone who practiced with the whole of themselves. I mentioned earlier that one reason we find it difficult to turn towards death is that we distance ourselves from the reality of it happening. We actually see a lot of it on television, on the news, but it's all very distant, often literally across the world. There's a very moving poem by Kukai that I know a lot of you will know, and it's all about impermanence. So I'd like to read it to you, and then I've made my own version, a kind of more up-to-date version of the poem. Anyway, this is Kukai. To a nobleman in Kyoto, that's the title. You asked me why I entered the mountain deep and cold. Awesome. Surrounded by steep peaks and grotesque rocks. A place that's painful to climb and difficult to descend. Wherein reside the gods of the mountains and the spirits of trees. Have you not seen, oh, have you not seen the peach and plum blossoms in the royal garden? They must be in full bloom, pink and fragrant, now opening in the April showers, now falling in the spring gales, flying high and low, all over the garden the petals scatter. Some sprigs may be plucked by the strolling spring maidens, and the flying petals picked by the flittering spring orioles. Have you not seen, oh, have you not seen the water gushing up in the divine spring of the garden? No sooner does it arise than it flows away forever. Thousands of shining lines flow as they come forth, flowing, flowing, flowing into an unfathomable abyss. Turning, whirling again, they flow on forever, and no one knows where they will stop. Have you not seen, oh, have you not seen, that billions have lived in China, in Japan, none have been immortal from time immemorial. Ancient sage kings or tyrants, good subjects or bad, fair ladies and homely, who could enjoy eternal youth? Noblemen and lowly alike, without exception, die away. They have all died, reduced to dust and ashes. The singing halls and dancing stages have become the abode of foxes. Transient as dreams, bubbles or lightning, all are perpetual travellers. Have you not seen, oh, have you not seen, this has been man's fate, how can you alone live forever? Thinking of this, my heart always feels torn. You too are like the sun going down behind the western mountains, or a living corpse whose span of life is nearly over. Futile would be my stay in the capital. Away, away I must go, I must not stay there. Release me, for I shall be master of the great void. A child of Shinnyon must not stay there. I have never tired of watching the pine trees and the rocks at Mount Koya. The limpid stream of the mountain is the source of my inexhaustible joy. Discard pride and earthly gains. Do not be scorched in the burning house, the triple world. Discipline in the woods alone lets us soon enter the eternal realm. One thing that struck me when I reread that poem recently was that the images it uses are fairly archaic and embedded in Japanese culture. So in order to bring its sentiments closer to home, I thought I'd kind of try doing a parallel version. Here it is. to a friend in Norwich. You ask me why I spend so much time alone in my cabin, wherein reside the distractions of the mind and the dark, unintegrated aspects of my psyche. Have you not seen, oh, have you not seen, the daily news of the destruction of Aleppo? Thousands have died or been made homeless, ancient buildings throughout the city reduced to rubble and ashes. Have you not seen, oh, have you not seen, the young people drinking and dancing happily in a Paris theatre, lying moments later in pools of each other's blood? Their grieving families deprived of loved sons and daughters, sisters and brothers. Have you not seen, oh, have you not seen, that even in the past year, so many talented men and women have disappeared from the earth? Leonard Cohen, Alan Rickman, Gene Wilder, Muhammad Ali, David Bowie, Carla Lane, Ronnie Corbett, Terry Wogan, George Michael, Victoria Wood, Prince, Andrew Sachs. They have all died, their voices gone forever. Presidents with good intentions and those misusing power, who of them will be alive in 50 years? Have you not seen, oh, have you not seen, that even these flickering candles on our beautiful shrine are changing minute by minute, melting into nothingness, just as we surely are? This has been man's fate. How can you alone live forever? Thinking of this, my heart always feels torn. You too are like the sun going down on the Norfolk horizon, or a living corpse whose span of life is nearly over. Futile would be my attachment to the city. I have never tired of watching the pine trees in my garden. The changing of the seasons is the source of my inexhaustible joy. Discard pride in earthly gains. Do not be tormented by the worldly winds. The Dharma alone lets us soon enter the eternal realm. Well, since we can't avoid the reality of death, we might as well take an interest in it and do all we can to prepare ourselves. For we can't predict how long our life will be. And we should remember that we have no evidence that being dead is unpleasant. I'd like to end with a very short anonymous quote. I'm going to read it twice. It's just a simple line, so that we can take it in. And then we'll just sit quietly, perhaps, if you don't mind, Diapana, for maybe 2 minutes to reflect. Death is not extinguishing the light. It is putting out the lamp because the dawn has come. Death is not extinguishing the light. It is putting out the lamp because the dawn has come.